It's not an overstatement to say, if not for Mr. Osterweil, I probably wouldn't be alive today. His classroom was that important for me.
Welcome to the third event in this series. For some of you, this may be your first entry point. In that case, you are in the right place. This conversation is both a foundational conversation and an anchor conversation for the entire arc of this work. It is also a framing conversation, one that provides intellectual orientation and a cornerstone conversation in the architectural sense upon which the rest of the entire podcast series rests. In the first two sessions, we asked a simple but urgent question. What does it mean to support equity-centered thriving in a time of disruption, politicization, and rapid technological change? We examined why this series exists. We explored the science of learning and development, and we began to name a different aspiration. Not minimal proficiency, not compliance, but thriving, grounded in well-being, animated by agency and sustained over time. This conversation with John King brings those ideas into a human focus. John reminds us that the school, at its best, is not merely an academic institution. It is a sanctuary, a place of safety, a place of intellectual challenge, a place where a young person is known, and that knowing can change a life trajectory. His story is not abstract. It is grounded in his lived experience, in teachers who built community, who combined rigor with nurturance, who created classrooms where a child could both belong and stretch. That insight is echoed and deepened in the accompanying dialogue with Linda Darling-Hammond and Bob Pianta. They remind us that education is fundamentally relational, that the brain develops through experience and connection, that excessive stress inhibits cognition, while psychological safety and belonging enhances it. They also remind us of something harder, that the dominant factory model of schooling, the press of pacing guides, standardized scripts, and punitive accountability is misaligned with what we know about human development. So if you're joining with us here, you are stepping into the structural center of this series. This conversation clarifies what we mean by equity-centered thriving. It makes visible what is too often invisible, that relationships are not ancillary to learning, they are its engines. If we are serious about thriving, then we must design systems that make relationships possible. We must organize schools for community. We must prepare teachers as developmental professionals, and we must trust them enough to practice their craft. As you listen, I invite you to consider what it would be to design every classroom as if relationships were the core architecture of learning. What would it mean to build systems that support groundedness, agency, and collective belonging? This is not simply another episode. It is the conversation that holds the entire podcast series together. Let us begin. I'd like to welcome John King, currently Chancellor of the State University of New York System, whose career in education has spanned leadership at every level, from helping to create and then lead Roxbury Preparatory Charter School to serving as New York State Commissioner of Education, U.S. Secretary of Education, and President of the Education Trust. John is also somebody I've had the privilege to know and work with over many years. An extraordinary human being and a deeply committed leader who brings not only expertise, but a profound belief in the power of education to change lives. What has always stood out to me about John is that he gets it, that education is not just about academics, but about creating environments where young people experience safety, belonging, challenge, and real opportunity. Places where they can thrive, both in the moment and over time. When I later read John's book, Teacher to Teacher, I came to understand more deeply how his own life experience shaped that understanding, why he has been so committed to ensuring that schools are places of care, possibility, and growth for every child. So I'd like to begin by inviting John to reflect on that. what he has learned from his life and experiences that informs how he thinks about schools, equity, and what young people need to truly thrive.
I think I've always been focused on issues of equity and the ways in which school can be more than just an academic institution for students, but really the place where they find safety, nurturing, relationship building, and develop the ability to thrive as adults. I've always been focused on that because that's what school did for me as a kid. I describe in the book growing up in Brooklyn in New York City. Both my parents were New York City public school educators, but they both passed away when I was little. My mom when I was 8 and my dad when I was 12. And in the period when it was just my dad and me, my dad was struggling with Alzheimer's. At home was incredibly difficult. Nobody knew he was sick. I didn't know what was wrong. Home was scary and unpredictable. Some nights my father would talk to me, some nights he wouldn't say a word. Some nights he'd be sad, other nights angry, sometimes violent. The thing that got me through that period was school. I had a series of amazing New York City public school teachers who didn't necessarily know what was going on for me at home, but knew the importance of making a classroom space that was safe, engaging, nurturing, supportive, challenging, interesting. I had one teacher who I talk about a fair amount in the book, Mr. Osterweil, who was my teacher in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, who created just this incredible classroom environment that was filled with learning. We read the New York Times every day. We did productions of Midsummer Night's Dream and Alice in Wonderland. He just created this space that was crucially important for me during that period. And he also showed us this whole world beyond Canarsie, Brooklyn, taking us on field trips to the Museum of Natural History and the ballet, having us learn the leader and capital of every country in the world. And it was such a gift. It's not an overstatement to say, if not for Mr. Osterweil, I probably wouldn't be alive today. His classroom was that important for me. When we had that first conversation about all the dimensions one needs to look at to think about the efficacy of a school environment, it made a lot of sense to me because I was the beneficiary of a very supportive school environment.
Let me build on that for a moment. What I hear in your story is that school and teachers like Mr. Osterweil created a place of safety, nurturance, and challenge, a haven that every young person deserves. You devoted much of your life to making that possible for others. So I want to ask, for educators and leaders listening, what should they be thinking about from the start if they want to create those kinds of environments? Ones that combine strong relationship, meaningful challenge, and a true sense of community. And how does that connect to what we know from the science of learning and development?
Yes. And there are so many elements there. I think I'd start with the notion that school ultimately is really about the relationship between a teacher and a student and the work in which they are engaged. The relationships are crucial, and it's the relationship that Mr. Osterweil had with me, the sense that he was going to be this supportive, emotionally constant presence who I knew wanted the best for me and from me. It's the relationships he cultivated in the classroom, helping the classroom community see each other as a source of support for each other. So much so that just this past weekend, we had a reunion of our sixth grade class. It's almost 40 years since we'd seen each other. And we got together as a class, and Mr. Osterweil came and we talked about our memories from his classroom and the impact he had on our lives. But he really created this sense of community for us. That's foundational, but also the work mattered that he created this academically rigorous environment where we had to write, where we had to think, where we had to explore ideas. And he was genuinely curious about what we thought about the world. When we were reading the New York Times every day, we had to write about and talk about the things we were discovering. And he was curious what a 9-year-old thought about the Cold War. That sense that you could, as a 9-year-old, have ideas about the world, and he was interested in them and wanting to engage around them, was an incredible gift. And there's a lot we can do in individual classrooms to create that mix of safety, nurturing, and intellectual engagement. But we have to be intentional about it. And we've talked about many times, we have to invest the resources to make it possible. If you're in a school where the teachers are overwhelmed because there aren't enough resources to address student needs, a school where there's no counselors, or the ratio of students to counselors is ridiculous, that students can't really get additional support. Schools where the buildings are deteriorating, where there aren't quality instructional materials. I even think about Mr. Oswald was able to take us on these field trips. There are some schools that have eliminated field trips, but those were hugely important for us.
Did you ever have a chance, either in your reflections on the school or in your conversations with Mr. Oswald, to get a sense of what were the conditions in the school that enabled him to be the type of teacher that he was?
Yes. A couple of things come to mind. One, the program that he was a part of was designed to be a place of diversity. Our class was racially diverse, socioeconomically diverse, and that was by design. And that created, I think, both opportunities for learning for all of us, but also meant that the school was better resourced than schools, sadly, that are segregated. We look around the country, not just in the South, but throughout the United States. When you have schools where students are segregated by race and class, often you have inadequate resources. And so the fact that ours was an intentionally integrated school environment was certainly a factor. The fact that the principal gave him the latitude to take us on field trips, to do a Shakespeare play. The principal didn't say, that's not in the standard curriculum, you can't do that. The principal understood why doing that Shakespeare production was actually going to be an amazing learning experience for us.
So, what did you play in Midsummer Night's Dream?
Actually, I learned years later that Mr. Ostrow had written an additional scene beyond the original play. I was a priest who married the couples at the end, which is not in the original Shakespeare production, although I only learned that later.
That again tells us something about the wonderful teacher he was, who was so student-centered. As I was listening to you, as a product of a pretty mediocre school system, who had a friend in graduate school who had gone to the Dalton School, her descriptions of her fifth grade are like your descriptions. And I think that's very important because I'll let you comment on it, because what we really want in equity-centered thriving that we'll talk about later is the conditions that are enriching and challenging, sometimes afforded to affluent children to be available to all children.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. One of the things that was special about PS276, they had this program, the ASTER program, which was supposed to be enrichment for gifted and talented students. And when our class began, fourth grade and fifth grade, we were part of that. But then by sixth grade, they had merged the sixth grade classes enriching activities are great for all kids. They aren't just things that the students who test well in kindergarten would benefit from. There are things that all students would benefit from.
Another thing I was hearing in your story is something that we don't always attend to. Education is not just an individual experience. It's not just supporting one child at a time, but about what happens within a community of learners and how those interactions shape development. Collective dynamics enrich learning. So I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I thought a lot about this when I was a teacher and then a principal, that you're really trying to create a sense of community in the classroom where students learn from each other, learn together, and feel invested in the success of their peers. One of my favorite teachers, when I think back to my education after leaving Mr. Ostrow's class, my 7th grade social studies teacher, Miss D, who I talk about in the book, created this classroom environment where we did all these collaborative projects that I still remember to this day and were so meaningful for me because home by that point was incredibly difficult. I was figuring out how to get food in our house, how to keep our household going. My father was, by that point, they were disconnected from reality. I remember one night he woke me at 2 in the morning, told me it was time to go to school. And I remember being in the staircase of our house. It's my father's pulling me on the stairs and I'm clinging to the banister and I'm saying, "No, Daddy, it's not time to go to school." And I didn't understand why he was doing that. That's what home was like. In school, I was involved in these projects that when I was doing them, that was all that mattered. I remember we did this project on the Aztecs, and I was the Aztec sportscaster in this Aztec newscast we were doing as classroom teams. And in that moment, the thing that mattered most to me was to be the best Aztec sportscaster there had ever been. That was such a gift. And Mr. Ostrow didn't know all the things that were going on at home, but it was such a gift to have this learning experience with my classmates. It was so compelling that I was able to find emotional safety and a sense of hope and purpose.
You know, that when you and I first met, John, I was doing work with the governor's office. I was working with Say Yes to Education, doing focus groups as part of the decision to see whether or not the model worked enough to try to replicate it at a larger level. I did focus groups with young people now in college or beyond college from the first cohorts. And while all the things that Say Yes did sounded like they were important, my takeaway from each of the focus groups was that the most important element was the group. The students talked about how at different points when they were about to drop out, someone else in the group would end up saying, "You can't, we got to do this together," and so forth. They used it to support each other when they were in different places in college and university and afterwards.
Yes.
And so that emotion, that collective emotional capital that is also social capital was probably there, an unintended gift of the initial model, but it's what the teachers you're talking about were doing as well.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And we see that at SUNY, we have scaled the ASAP and ACE wraparound support programs, which have been shown in RCTs to as much as double community college completion for low-income students. And there are multiple elements: intensive advising, emergency financial assistance, transportation subsidy. But crucial to the program is this cohort experience where you feel a part of community that is invested in you and your success.
So let me take us in a slightly different direction, John. I'd like to go back to your work at Roxbury Prep and what you were trying to create there. In many ways, what you described about your own experience, what Mr. Osterweil and others created for you, feels like it shows up again in that work. So I'd like to ask, what were you trying to build at Roxbury Prep? And what did you learn there that others, no matter where they teach or work, can take away from that experience?
Yeah, in so many ways, what we were doing at Roxbury Prep was trying to create at a school level the things that Mr. Osterweil and Miss D had done for me. The goal, and this was a middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, the goal was to have students come to us who often were behind academically, third grade reading skills, fourth grade math skills, coming to us in sixth grade. But we had the goal that we were going to make sure that when they left us in eighth grade, they were on track to go to college. And we would work with them to place them in high schools that were college preparatory. Later, after I left, they expanded the school to high school. So now it's a middle and high school. At the time, we were really focused on how do you in middle school put students on the right trajectory? And some of the things were very fundamental. Our school day was longer, our school year was longer. More time was incredibly valuable. We spent a lot of time with faculty on careful planning of the instruction. The teachers would come back 3.5 weeks before the students to look at student work, plan the curriculum for the year, look back at the past year and try to refine their practices. To collaborate with each other, to think about things we could do that were interdisciplinary. That careful preparation, I think, strengthened the academics. We built the schedule so that even though our day was longer and our year was longer, we actually ended a little bit earlier on Fridays, the same time as the local neighborhood schools, so that teachers would have 2.5 hours every week for joint planning time, to watch video of instruction together. To meet in grade level teams and talk about students and say, is this student struggling? What do they need? And who should intervene with them? That created a culture of intense reflection about instructional practice, but also a very strong sense of community amongst the teachers that we were on a team trying to support our students. We invested a lot in sense of community. For the students, we do a community meeting every week and celebrate the star student of the week with a special spirit stick. We would surprise the whole room with who is the spirit stick's winner that week, and kids would get so excited because they saw each other as part of a team, part of a community. We spent a lot of time engaging families and would have food and babysitting when we'd have family nights so that parents could come and not be worried about all the things going on in their lives, but focus on their kids. So, that sense of bringing together academic rigor with a strong sense of community and strong relationships was our goal. We became the highest performing urban middle school in the state, which we're very proud of. More than that, I'm so proud of the kids. One of my kids, from when I later came back to the school to be, the principal. She came back, taught math,
Whoa.
principal. Another one of our kids is in the Massachusetts State Legislature representing the community. That's what's ultimately most satisfying. Yes, they did better on the assessments, but in the long run, what matters is I think their life
Yeah.
trajectories were different.
As you're talking, I'm reminded of something I once heard Lisa Delpert say to a conference of education researchers. She asked us to imagine responding to a question from a grandchild at the end of our life and saying, "I wish I had done better on high-stake tests." And of course, the audience cracked up.
That's right. Yeah, it's a means to an end. It's an indicator. And look, we want students to have strong reading skills, strong math skills, but that's not the goal. That's not the outcome that we're looking for. We don't want for our, whether it's for our own kids. Lisa Delpit's book, the title is Other People's Children. We should want for other people's children what we would want for our own, which is a good, meaningful, fulfilling life.
John, I want to introduce a conceptualization that will guide much of this conversation and the podcast series, equity-centered thriving. Equity-centered thriving is the capacity to thrive both in the moment and over time, not only academically, but across all areas of life. It is grounded in well-being, and it includes three key dimensions. First, the experience of individual and collective well-being, for example, with classmates and teachers. Second, the experience of individual and collective groundedness, the capacity to feel connected to a past, a present, and a future, and to know that you have a place in the world, that we have a place in the world. And third, the experience of individual and collective agency, the capacity to act. And as you have done across the course of your life, to shape your circumstances and your future. So I'd like to ask you to reflect on that. How does this conceptualization resonate with your experience? And what does it suggest about what schools should be designed to do?
Yeah, look, there's a lot about that definition of equity-centered thriving that resonates with how I thought about what school could and should be. Part of what I hear in that definition is also, sadly, a mirror we could hold up to our current system and see that we are falling short for so many kids. I remember once reading a survey that was done of some high school students in LA, and they asked students to name an adult at school who would be proud of them. And I thought that was such a great question
Interesting.
because to be proud of you know someone to be proud of them.
Yeah.
You have to be invested in them. And the thing that was so distressing about the survey result was how few kids could name an adult who would be proud of them. And that is a huge shortcoming. And so when I hear your description of thriving, I think about the kids who aren't getting that and the ways in which our systems are therefore failing and really failing the long-term interests of our society. Because we are all better off if all of our kids are positioned to thrive.
And that goes back to your point about Lisa Delpit's title of her book. Ideally, all parents want their children to thrive. Sometimes that it can't happen. It was happening to your dad at a certain point where that was no longer possible. That's built into our own biologies, the
Yes.
connection between a parent and a child. We want that same connectivity between a teacher and other children who may not look like them, may
Right.
be very different, but who are just as deserving, wonderful, and filled with the same potential as their children.
Yes. And I think one of the things we have to do to get there is help adults who are involved in children's lives see their strengths and assets. One of my favorite programs that we funded through the Investing in Innovation grants at the U.S. Education Department when I worked for President Obama was a program called Building Assets, Reducing Risks. Amazing program started by a school counselor in Minnesota who saw that in her high school, low-income students, immigrant students were less likely to graduate. And so she went to her principal and said, I think we can make this better if we create time for the teachers and counselors to meet about a group of students, talk through each of the students and figure out who's struggling and who needs an adult to intervene. And then importantly, figure out for each student, what are they good at? What do they love? What are they passionate about? And figure out as a group, how are we going to tap into that to leverage that for their overall success? This program she showed in her high school, they did random assignment because there were so many students who needed intervention and they could only serve some. So they had random assignment to figure out whether the intervention was working. It did. She scaled it in the district. She got an I3 grant. to scale it to multiple districts. She came back and got another I3 grant at a higher evidence tier because the evidence was so strong of this program. And now it's been replicated across the country. And one of my favorite things about it is their tagline is something like same teacher, same students, different results. It's about how we organize ourselves to support our kids.
How do we start the creation of a spark somehow? Where does
Yes.
that come from? How are you doing that now?
Such a great question. I share three observations. One, when I was student teaching, I tell this story in the book. I was student teaching at Beacon High School, and I did this lesson with political cartoons, pictures, and maps. I taught the lesson, and students were totally bored and disengaged. And my cooperating teacher, Harry Streep, very kindly, gently said to me, "You plan that lesson based on all the things you were going to do during the lesson, and you didn't plan it based on all the things the students were going." And so I had all these different elements to the lesson, but they were all basically about me at the front of the room and the kids absorbing, as opposed to a lesson where the kids were doing the intellectual work. One conversation with Harry Streep changed how I just thought about lesson planning and the academic experience. So that's one observation. A second observation is, and I know both of you have had this experience, no matter how struggling the school you go to, when you get there, somebody says, "Things are really tough here, but you got to go into Mr. Long's classroom." And you walk into that classroom, and it's like you're transported to a whole different place. So the rest of the school could be chaotic, kids aren't really learning, and things are not working. But you walk into Mr. Long's classroom, the moment you walk through that door, it's different. Kids are learning, focus, treating each other and the teacher respectfully. One of the weaknesses of how we do teacher prep is we don't necessarily lift up those classrooms. We don't orient prospective teachers to those magical classrooms. Spending time in those rooms, observing, seeing those teachers can make a huge difference for whether or not folks are prepared to be effective. We do very little hands-on in teacher prep compared to what we do in medicine. I remember when I was secretary visiting the teacher residency program in Louisiana. In that ed school, some students were in the residency and some did the usual short spring student teaching. A young man who was a first-year teacher said to me, "The residency made all the difference for me because I know what's supposed to happen in August and September." He was an elementary school teacher. And what every elementary school teacher knows, the whole game is August and September, right? How do you set the routines? How do you set the norms? How do you show students this is what we do here? He pointed out that because he'd done a residency, he'd been in the classroom of a strong teacher from the very beginning of the year. His classmates who did student teaching in the spring, they'd never seen what August and September should look like. So they came into the classroom with no idea. And then by December, they were tired, burnt out, frustrated because they hadn't set good routines because they didn't know to set good routines. And so I do think like our design of teacher prep does not align with the outcome we really want.
You know that teachers are unprepared to be able to embody the principles
Yes.
of the science of learning and development in their practice.
And we desperately need that. And it is one of the biggest gaps between our sector and healthcare, for example, that we are very intentional about making sure doctors understand the best evidence, the best science. We also are willing to revise that over time as new evidence emerges. We don't take that approach in the education sector very often. I know Linda and you and others have worked to try and change that.
Well, what's interesting in the medical sector is that they're also learning that you want the best evidence about what works, but also to understand what works. And so there's now more emphasis in medical school and medical practice on that R that you were talking about before, relationship.
Including having people do a lot more practice and simulation. I was struck visiting one of our nursing programs. We were talking about end-of-life care and how difficult it is, the human part of that, like setting aside the task of the nurse, but the
Yes.
human part of being with someone through that,
Yeah.
being with their family members through that. And that's something you can role play, you can practice in ways that will help you prepare for what is a very difficult and complex relational activity. And we need more of that in schools. When I was a principal, one of the things that I would do with our new teachers, we would do role plays on conversations with parents. That grew out of my own experience as a first-year teacher. My teacher prep program was very good in many respects, but we never talked about families. And I remember the first time my principal came in and said, "Hey, parent-teacher conferences next week. Good luck." I had no idea what happened in parent-teacher conferences. We'd never talked about it in teacher prep. I'd never been to one. And my only model for teacher prep conferences was the TV show Growing Pains. I remembered the scene in Growing Pains where Alan Thicke had to come in and meet with the teacher. And that was my only reference point. And so we would do these role plays. How do you talk to a parent about their kids struggling academically? How do you talk to a parent about their kids struggling socio-emotionally? How do you talk to a parent about difficult things at home carrying over to school? For young new teachers, practicing that can make it much better when they have to do it for real.
I think the point that you just made about what doesn't happen in teacher prep really talks again about how teachers are unprepared. The fact that the importance of families being engaged by them, engaging them, and working with them is not seen as central to the enterprise. It may not even be seen as a piece of the enterprise.
That's right.
John, one of the things you talk about in your book is the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are principles that are fully consistent with what we know about how children learn and develop. They are principles of what we know from sociology and history about what's necessary to create societies that actually might work. They're also terms that have been weaponized and undermined in different ways. I'd like to hear from you both about your sense of the importance of those issues, but also thinking not just from your position now in New York State, where you have some ability to try to address that, but for people who may be in places where they have a little less space to operate. How should they be thinking about these issues?
What's happening now around diversity, equity, and inclusion is heartbreaking because you have this weaponization of the notion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, this distortion of what it means, and that's being used to divide people. In truth, diversity, equity, and inclusion is about bringing people together. For me, it's really a question of how we prepare young people to have empathy, to not only reflect on their own experience, but try to understand the experience of people who are different from them. And that could be different because their racial or ethnic background is different. It could be because they have different abilities or disabilities. It could be because they've grown up in different economic circumstances. But what we want in a healthy society is for people to be able to have empathy for each other. And the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion is about that. It is also about ensuring that we give everyone the opportunity to be successful. And I understand some folks would like to stop looking at those issues because it's hard to grapple with the disparities that we have on the basis of race in so many aspects of American life, whether we're talking about education, health, or economic opportunity. But looking away doesn't make it go away. Those disparities are still there. And so we have to acknowledge them and work through them and try to address the gaps in opportunity. This attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion strikes me as very dangerous to the long-term health of American democracy. We can only find a way forward together. John Lewis had this thing he would say, "We all may have come here on different ships, but we're in the same boat now." We've got to find a path forward that acknowledges our interconnectedness. For me at SUNY, I would say DEI is in our DNA. When we were founded more than 75 years ago, the enabling statute talks about providing the broadest possible access and serving all segments of New York. That's who we are. That's what we're going to do. And those are the values we're going to try to actualize, even in this complicated environment.
And if I'm right, Mr. Osterwile not only created that place filled with diversity, equity, inclusion, but did it in part because it could create the type of learning for everyone that creativity in our society needs.
Yes, absolutely. And if folks need evidence of the return on investment, it is clear. You look at companies that have diverse leadership, their outcomes are better. You look at teams that are able to bring different perspectives, outcomes are better. We've got to get to a better place. Part of that was that folks who care about diversity, equity, and inclusion work, we have to be careful not to demonize the folks who are expressing reservations. We have to find a way to talk through those and work through those. There are people who feel like because of diversity, equity, and inclusion, they somehow have been disadvantaged. And we have to help people see that the work on diversity, equity, and inclusion is a way to grow the pie, expand opportunity, expand possibility for everybody.
John, thank you. We could continue this conversation much longer, but I want to acknowledge how much you've shared with us today. This has been a powerful and meaningful discussion. Before we turn to our next conversation, let's sit briefly with what John has offered us. John's story is personal, but it is not simply autobiographical, it is instructive. When he speaks of Mr. Osterwile, about safety, rigor, belonging, and challenge, he's describing more than kindness. He's describing conditions, conditions that altered a life trajectory. John reminds us that education is fundamentally relational, that equity is not rhetoric. It is whether a child is known. It is where the school community becomes a protective and developmental force. But powerful stories, however compelling, are not enough. Our next conversation move us from testimony to evidence and action, from lived experience to science. They show us that relationships are not peripheral to learning. We must ask, was John just another luck and pluck story that we can read about in People magazine, or was his experience consistent with what we know from developmental science? That question brings us to Linda Darling Hammond and Barb Pianta. Linda Darling Hammond is president of the California State Board of Education and founding president of the Learning Policy Institute, an organization she created to connect rigorous research to real-world policy and practice. Robert Pianta is the Batten Bicentennial Professor Emeritus at the University of Virginia, former Dean of the School of Education and Human Development. and founding director of the Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning. His work has fundamentally reshaped how we understand and measure teacher-student relationships and the conditions for learning in classrooms.
There's a river flowing in my soul. There's a river flowing in my soul, and it's telling me that I'm somebody. There's a